Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Okay, I'll chant this one myself.
Te niniyodakam sarve vilapya cha brisham punaha apluta haripadabja rajakputa saridjale.
Okay. Te. Okay. All of them.
Niniya.
Having offered
udakam
water,
sarve,
every one of them,
vilapya,
having lamented,
cha,
and
brisham,
sufficiently,
punaha,
again,
apluta,
took bath,
haripadabja,
the lotus feet of the Lord,
rajaha,
dust,
puta,
purified,
sarit,
of the Ganges,
jale,
in the water.
Translation by Srila Prabhupada.
Having lamented over them and sufficiently offered Ganges water, they bathed in the Ganges, whose water is sanctified due to being mixed with the dust of the lotus feet of the Lord.
They're lamenting because they just performed the funeral ceremony for everyone on their side who was killed in the Kurukshetra battle. That's a lot to lament for. And they offered the departed souls. For the departed souls, they offered Ganges water. And then, because after death of a family member, everyone's impure, they purified themselves by taking bath in the Ganges. And then life goes on after that. Text 3. But this is the context after this total calamity, and everyone is, all the family members have been cremated. Then we read what happens next.
Tatrasinam kurupatim dhritarashtram sahanujam gandharim putrashokartam pritam krishnam jamadavaha tatra sinam kurupatim dhritarashtram sahanujam gandharim putrashokartam pritam krishnam chamadavaha.
Tatra, there,
Asinam,
sitting. Kurupatim,
the king of the Kurus.
Dhritarashtram,
Dhritarashtra.
Saha Anujam,
with his younger brothers.
Gandharim,
Gandhari.
Putra,
Shoka. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say Putra? Putra's son.
Shoka
Artam, overtaken by bereavement.
Pritam,
Kunti.
Krishnam,
Draupadi.
Cha,
also.
Madhavaha,
Lord Sri Krishna. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. But first, this verse doesn't finish the sentence. Where does the sentence end? Yeah, next verse finishes the sentence and adds on an extra gerund clause, darshayan clause. Okay. There's a main verb and there's also a subordinate verb in the next verse. I was told an interesting theory by Radha Krishna Prabhu yesterday that an opinion of some Babaji, and maybe an opinion of Jiva Goswami, but we're not sure. The Bhagavatam can be counted according to this numbering the sentences, and you'll get 18,000 that way if you count the sentences. But I don't know, because often the sentences are longer than the shlokas. Sometimes not, but nobody has ever actually tried to do it, to count all the sentences. That takes a lot of grammatical analysis and arithmetic to do that. Anyway, translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. There sat the king of the Kurus, Maharaj Yudhishthira, along with his younger brothers, and Dhritarashtra, Gandhari, Kunti, and Draupadi, all overwhelmed with grief. Lord Krishna was also there. Purport. The battle of Kurukshetra was fought between family members, and thus all affected persons were also family members like Maharaj Yudhishthira and brothers Kunti, Draupadi, Subhadra, Dhritarashtra, Gandhari, and her daughters-in-law, etc. All the principal dead bodies were in some way or other related to each other, and therefore the family grief was combined. Lord Krishna was also one of them, as a cousin of the Pandavas and nephew of Kunti, as well as brother of Subhadra, etc. The Lord, therefore, was equally sympathetic toward all of them, and therefore began to pacify them befittingly. It's customary in a funeral the women should walk in front. I'm not sure. With most Vedic rituals like that, you can't tell a reason. It's just that's the injunction. But women are especially prominent in all kinds of religious ceremonies, but especially weddings and funerals. But in this case, there's a predominance of women for a different reason, is that most of the men are dead. Their bodies have just been burned. Therefore, there's so many women being described here. Hare Krishna. And there's a mention of Kurupati, the king of the Kurus. Previously, that would have referred to Yudhishthir, but not anymore. Now things have changed, and the Kurupati is... Did I say Yudhishthir? It would have previously referred to Dhritarashtra. He's always been called
the king of the Kurus.
Just, you know, technically he's supposed to be, although he can't sit on the throne. And he usurped the throne, putting his sons on it. So, you know, he's always been called the king of the Kurus. But now the issue has been decided, and he's acknowledged it at the end of the previous chapter. Is it previous chapter or next chapter? No, it's next chapter. Chakara Raja Dharmena Pitrapaimana. At the end of this chapter, we'll read a verse about Yudhishthir. Anyway. Pitra Chanamuto Raja Vasudevana Moditha Chakara Raja Dharmena Pitrapaitamaham Vibhu. So Yudhishthir, although he had a lot of hesitation, he didn't want to assume the throne, with a lot of discussion that finally had to be settled by Bhishmadev. This is in the next chapter. Bhishmadev is still lying on the bed of arrows on the battlefield. They've collected the corpses. The battlefield is deserted, but they left Bhishmadev lying there all by himself. Everyone else went to the funerals. He's lying there by himself out in the battlefield. So he's going to give instructions to Yudhishthir that, like, as no one else, including Krishna, could do, convince Yudhishthir to accept the throne. And it says, in the translation, Pitra here means uncle, because Yudhishthir's father isn't around right now. He hasn't been around for many years. But his substitute father is Dhritarashtra, the brother of Pandu. So, given permission by his uncle Dhritarashtra and by the Supreme Lord Vasudev, Yudhishthir accepts the throne. That's the statement. Not just by might of force, by right of might, which is the normal way for Kshatriyas to take power. If there's a disagreement among Kshatriyas, a serious disagreement, then there's a fight. And whoever fights better, whoever's stronger and more skillful in fight and wins, takes everything. But Brahmins can't do that. You know, we have a disagreement, philosophical disagreement, okay, we'll wrestle, and whoever can pin the other one is right. You know, you're right because you're stronger? For a Brahmin, it doesn't make sense, but that's the way Kshatriyas settle questions. That's how they do politics. Not by reasoning, not by philosophy, but by killing whoever disagrees with you. But in this case, because this is a Dharma Yuddha, that word will come up at the end of this chapter. It was a fight fought according to religious principles. Therefore, it's not sufficient just to win the battle and defeat soundly your enemy. What is required is to be authorized, because we're dealing in spiritual matters here. Spiritual matters, right doesn't make might doesn't make right. Even logic doesn't make right. Even you can prove yourself logically right, you're still wrong if you're not authorized. If you don't get the blessing of your acharya, all your logical knowledge, all the information you have packed in your head, has no power. Power comes from the sanction of the spiritual authority in all versions of spiritual life, Brahminical, Kshatriya, whatever mode you're functioning in. But if you're on the spiritual, if you're supposed to be a devotee of the Lord, a Vaishnava, then all your activities need to be authorized by the blessings of the spiritual superiors. So Yudhishthira, therefore, was able to properly accept the throne because he had the permission of Dhritarashtra
and the encouragement of Krishna. They were both in favor of this idea. Dhritarashtra, because he finally admitted defeat, what could he do? His whole plan was to put his son on the throne. He had 100 sons. If somehow Duryodhan died, if suppose Bhima just lost his temper and smashed his head in one day, he had 99 other sons. And he assumed that he could get one of his sons on the throne. But now, Bhima and Arjun and their co-fighters have killed every one of his sons except for the one who's the son of a Vaishya. Yuyudhana. Not Yuyudhana. Yuyutsu. What does it mean? Yuyutsu? He wanted to fight, but he couldn't. Because he wasn't a Kshatriya. I think he was not fighting on the battle. That's why he's still alive. Otherwise, Bhima would have made sure, according to his vow, that he wouldn't be still alive. But Yuyutsu is on the list with all the ladies. He's there. Of people present now, who are present for the various discussions, who was there when Vidura returned home and convinced Dhritarashtra to leave home, Yuyutsu was there sitting listening and greeting Vidura. But the other sons are all dead. There's no reason to pursue his ambition anymore because the center of his focus of his ambition, his sons, are all dead. He might as well, you know, now be a little gracious and voluntarily offer the kingdom to Yudhishthir. There's no resisting now. So he does. He asks Yudhishthir to take the throne. And then it's official. Yeah. The person who other claimant to the throne has asked you to accept it. Of course, if this had been done a couple of years before, then the whole conflict would have been avoided. But Dhritarashtra had to fight to the end and lose everything. Not like Ravana because he opposed this Krishna directly, but because he opposed Krishna's dear devotees, which is just as bad or worse. Anyway, here's the situation now. Everyone's sitting lamenting or overwhelmed with grief, except for one person. And who's that? Madhava. The Supreme... Krishna. He's smiling. Everyone else has got a sad face, but Krishna. It's not that, you know, he's living in a different world. Not really. But he's the Supreme Lord. So nothing, everything's sanctioned by him. Whatever, everyone else is totally bewildered. Why did this have to happen? Why did they all have to be killed? Why did the sons of the Pandavas also have to be killed, even though they survived to the last day of the through the last day of the battle? Why did they have to be killed also? But Krishna was not bewildered. It all happened according to his intention. So devotees may be pure, but because we're not God, we can become confused. Krishna's maya is very strong. Even his yoga maya is even stronger. And therefore, whichever maya we're under the influence of, we can be overwhelmed by grief and other emotions and lose our intelligence. Well, okay, that means we can't trust, we can't depend completely on our own intelligence to save us. That's the delusion of an intellectual. Especially if he's proud of his intelligence, he thinks that this intelligence will, you know, make him see through all illusions no matter what happens. And in the real world, it's not necessarily like that all the time. Even the most intelligent person can lose his intelligence under the
you know, the circumstances, the terrible circumstances that can confront us. Even the most sober person can lose his sobriety. Even yogis lose their yogic power because Maya is stronger than all of us. So it wouldn't be very appropriate if the Pandavas weren't lamenting, if they would act like Stoics or indifferent, then the pastimes wouldn't be proper. There wouldn't be the right enjoyment. Krishna wouldn't enjoy the pastimes. The devotees weren't playing the roles. But playing a role in Krishna's pastime is not just play acting. We think actors on a stage are performing a fiction and the reality is off the stage. Well, that's true. But in the case of the play of Krishna's pastimes, it's just the other way around. What we do when we're not involved in Krishna's pastimes, our so-called ordinary life, that's illusion. It's not quite real. It's a reflection of reality. We think we're serving masters and maintaining dependents. It's just a game, like children playing family. You know, someone's the father, someone's the children. But it's just play, and it breaks up after an hour. Similarly, all our relationships in this world break up after a few years. And everyone drifts apart, and you know, those relationships weren't real. All our dependencies and all our everyone being dependent on us and us being dependent on others, it's all just play, make-believe play. But once we become acquainted to our eternal function within Krishna's pastimes, which eventually we might, if we continue practicing devotional service, the purpose of it is that we can re-enter Krishna's pastimes. And then we'll discover that the reality is over on that side. That what you... Because you're analyzing devotional service in terms of drama, you know, you're using the same terminology that Bharat Muni uses in his Natya Shastra of the rasas, and the role, apparent role playing in devotional reciprocation with Krishna and his pastimes. But that play acting is the reality, and everything else in our life is make believe. So the devotees who are sitting now don't think that they're not really feeling sorry, that they're above all of it. They're experiencing all the pain, more than we would. Or, well, it's not, I don't know, more, but anyway, they're experiencing real pain. They're actually suffering. And that's their contribution to Krishna's pastimes. So we should, I mean, Bhagavatam is the original Rasa Shastra. If Bhagavatam is teaching devotional service and teaching it in any thorough way, not just a survey for beginners that doesn't really just touches on the surface, if it's not just that, then Bhagavatam has to teach the essence of devotional service, and that is rasa. So Bhagavatam is full of rasa. There are real emotions, spiritual emotions, being expressed throughout the Bhagavatam. These feelings are real. They're really being experienced by the persons who are involved. And such spiritual drama can transform us, even though we're not currently participants in these or any particular pastimes of Krishna, where we have forgotten our relationship with Krishna and may not recover it again for many, many years. Just like we have a room here full of people suffering from amnesia. Maybe somebody here. I don't remember. What's my sarupa? Anybody here remember his sarupa? before I insult you? Okay. Well, okay, so we all agree we haven't. That means we're suffering from amnesia. Just like I'm giving a class in front of people who forgot their name, don't remember who their family are, where they come from. They're all sitting here. Okay, let's have a Bhagavatam class. We don't know who we are. Like that. We're a room full of amnesiacs. But someday we expect, that we've been told by reciting and studying this Bhagavatam, eventually we remember who we are. Eventually we will remember who we are. And not only that, we have a very special friend. We just have forgotten about him, and the book is going to reintroduce us to our best friend. Okay, therefore we read it. Sitting here not knowing who we are. But the people we're reading about, what's better about them than us is that they remember, they do know who they are. This is not fiction, and these people are not just play acting, that they're assuming a role other than the real role. What they are is what they really are. And that's in their relationship with Krishna. Therefore, it's all auspicious. Even, you know, battlefield covered with blood and, you know, vultures are wandering around to see if they can find one last corpse still left there. So that's all auspicious. Everyone crying, full of grief. It's all auspicious because Krishna was also there. Krishna's sitting there. And Krishna arranged the whole thing anyway. Okay, any questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is pertaining to what you were discussing in the beginning, how Yudhishthir took back the throne. This is quite a basic question of mine. So how do you, like as devotees, we understand it was Krishna's will. So many people. I mean that the battlefield of Kurukshetra was happened, but for many people, it's a hard thing to accept that God sanctioned such a big battle, and it seems that you this how like the concept of religious war, or that Yudhisthira had the right to take the throne and to kill so many people for taking the throne. It seems that he was just hungry for power.
Yes.
So can you
elaborate on this? Well, I mean, here in India, I don't find a lot of people complaining about it. Yeah, you know, a lot of I don't find Indians rejecting. I mean, there's some people in India that you can always find some crackpot, you know, rejects all religion and just wants to go against everything. But normally the vast majority of the population in this country don't have a problem accepting, you know, the story of the Pandavas, Mahabharata. You know, they're encouraging their children to read it. When it's on TV, everyone, you know, is around the TV. Well, this is back in 1981, maybe. No, the original showing of the Mahabharata. It was way back. It was before everybody had a television set. You know, especially in Bangalore, they didn't have, until later in the same year, they didn't even have a television studio in Bangalore. Well, the first time I'm talking about, the first time it was shown. So there weren't many television sets because there was no real broadcasting in Bangalore yet. Early 1981. Later in the year, which? But I'm talking before this. I was there. This is the first showing. The first showing was, it must have been in 1980 or 81, because I was there. In Bangalore. They maybe re-showed it 10 years later, but this is the first showing. There were only some small number of television sets in the city. So when the show came on Saturday, like everyone shut their shops and they went to wherever there was a TV set, and there'd be 100 people in front of, or more, in front of every television set because Mahabharata was on. I didn't see, people complaining. that, wait a minute, this is, you know, nonsense. You know, Krishna made a battle to kill everybody. You know, look, well, who's he? Why did he do that? Maybe in Canada people would complain about it, but not in India. Okay, now I have to answer the question, because some people in the world are just, you know, don't see things the same way. In fact, when Prabhupada went to New York, many of his people who were attracted to him and wanted to, you know, listen to him, the young New Yorkers, they were complaining. You know, why is the battlefield, why is Gita spoken on a battlefield, and why is Krishna telling Arjuna to fight? Isn't war evil? You know, don't we have an evil war going on right now? Vietnam War? And how can we be preaching, you know, the glories of war? So yeah, there's complaints, but that's misunderstanding. Krishna promoted particular wars. In fact, he participated very enthusiastically in certain wars. Krishna favors the Kshatriyas, and the Kshatriyas pursuing their Kshatriya roles. He doesn't want Kshatriyas to be nonviolent. That doesn't mean he likes violence, that Krishna likes war per se. But war also serves its function. Just like epidemics also serve their function. The AIDS epidemic is serving a function in the plan of God. You may not like that. You may think the AIDS epidemic is the worst evil in the, you know, of the century. But actually, it's not bad in the overall plan of God. Right? You got to see things from God's viewpoint. You know, you think it's bad that there's violence, but there's violence because people are violent. If people could settle their differences reasonably, there wouldn't be any wars. If people were not, you know, if people were satisfied just to be greedy, you know, to a personal extent, you know, to become rich, you know, then normally businessmen, they may try to put one another out of business. But they don't do it by physically violent means normally, although I know I've seen in Russia where our temple was, there was a pizza parlor that got blown up by competitors. You know, things like that go on sometimes. But normally businessmen, you know, they try to annihilate their businessmen, but in a peaceful way. They try to annihilate their competitors, but peacefully. But unfortunately, there are people in the world who are not satisfied with peaceful competition. They're rajasic by nature. And if someone is opposing them, they have to destroy that opposition. Not enough just to put them out of business. You have to literally put them out of business, send them to Yamaraj. Because there are people like that, there are wars. Is that Krishna's fault? God didn't want people to be stuck in the mode of passion. He made the mode of passion available for those who wanted it. And therefore, he arranges for wars so that people with a passionate nature can work out their passion. Otherwise, they'll just go crazy. If they can't fight a war, they won't be able to tolerate living. They got to go out and kill somebody and get killed. Otherwise, they can't tolerate living. So Krishna arranges the battles and the wars. And don't blame him for it. Purusha sukadukanam bhoktritve hetu ruchyate. It's the finite living entity, not God, who's the cause of his enjoyment and suffering. You can put war under the category of suffering. In some sense, the warriors may enjoy their fighting, but generally for everybody involved, warfare is suffering. And the cause of the living entity's suffering is the living entity himself. Don't blame Krishna for it. Okay, so you have to go back to Canada and explain that to everybody. Okay. Yes. Bhartrampapu and then Ram.
Hare Krishna. you said that people here don't have a problem accepting that. Maybe there because they're seeing this Vietnam War and it's an evil. But here also they're seeing wars. But generally, even all the movies are made in that pattern. Like there's a story and there's a hero who is having good qualities, and then there's a villain, and at the end there's a big massacre of
Everyone gets killed. Yeah.
Everyone gets killed, and only the hero survives. Most of the films are made in that pattern. And the wars here that they've seen is like they see Pakistan trying to use up Kashmir, and then the army fights and it wins. So for them, war is, they can understand that war performed for dharma very easily. And another thing is Vishnu,
that's pretty good. If there's some concept of war as dharma, then you do things properly. If you think that your being married to your wife is supposed to be dharma, then you act properly. Or you have an idea that you should. If you think that you being a fighter and fighting a war, or your country fighting a war, is supposed to be dharma, then it's supposed to be done right, done properly.
Yeah. I think there's one name for Vishnu in Vishnu Sahasranam. He's got a name, Ranapriya, the one who likes war.
Who is that?
Vishnu has got a name, Ranapriya.
That's his name.
Ranapriya, one who likes war. I don't know if it can be interpreted some other way.
Well, let's say he likes to fight.
Oh, yeah, he likes to fight.
Yeah. It's not like he just likes to send other people out to fight, but he likes to be right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So does any real Kshatriya. Yeah. So Vishnu can also be a Kshatriya whenever he wants to.
Yes. But in history, if you see, there have been also instances where perfect Vaishnava kings fought with each other. Like Prataparudra was such a perfect, like he had taken shelter of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And we have Krishnadevaraya in the south. He was disciple of Vyasatirtha.
Yes.
And he was also serving Vaishnavas personally.
Yes.
Washing their feet. And he was such a humble person. But Krishnadevaraya and Prataparudra couldn't tolerate each other. They fought and Krishnadevaraya defeated Prataparudra in two battles.
Yes.
And until Prataparudra gave his son, gave his daughter to Krishnadevaraya as a wife. But they are, both of them are perfect Vaishnavas. Like,
they fought over some dry land in the middle of India. Yeah. But okay, that's Kshatriya nature. And, ordinary citizens got killed in those fights. But that's the way things are. That's the material world.
The Vaishnava culture didn't save them from...
Did not save them?
From this kind of fighting spirit.
Well, Vaishnava culture is not meant... Oh. Vaishnava culture promotes it. Promotes the fighting spirit in the right people. The fighters should fight. Because there's going to be need for fighting. If we develop a complete culture, not just a couple of little ashrams and everyone else out there, having to work in offices and factories, but if we develop a complete functioning Vaishnav culture, then we'll have to have Kshatriyas also. People ready to fight. Oh, we have a little of that already, but... Just because two people are fighting doesn't make them Kshatriyas. Yeah, but Kshatriyas, yeah. It's hard for Kshatriyas to let someone else be in charge. So better you give each one a separate kingdom and keep them apart. We have that also in this God. Okay. Yeah. Rimpu? We're actually over time.
Maybe
5 minutes over time.
I can ask later.
We actually have. I'll answer your question because I said I would.
I can.
But I went over time. We're actually supposed to stop at 7:15 and have kirtan, right? Okay, go ahead.
Okay, just thank you for this wonderful class. I just want to ask something. You mentioned class. Is there any Puranic explanation why the sons of Draupadi had to be murdered? Just a point.
There likely might be. I don't know it. Why? First of all, they weren't babies; they were on the battlefield fighting. They were 16 years old or something.
But why they had to get murdered in their sleep after surviving everything else, is there any account of that? Why? Something in their past life? Might be, but I don't know it. Okay. All right, we'll stop here. Thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.